I want to talk about the way libraries develop, and we can say like trees or weeds or meadows. And there are many ways of being, of defining a special collection according to the nature and the identity of a library. So I'm going to talk first of very old libraries, let's say Sainte-Geneviève in Paris. It used to be a religious library, then it was a college library, then now it's a state library linked with a university. When you go in the room which is called reserve, so special collections, rare books, well, you find books that have been at this place forever. So when they were monks, that was the library of the monastery. When it was a school, that was the school library. And so you have several layers of books which just stayed there, were left where they were. So, of course, that's not what we'll have here, because this library opened in 1963, and there was nothing in here before except meadows and woods. So the second way this growth can happen and this retention too of books can be seen is in a library like Louvain. So that was the famous trilingual college founded in 1517 so that scholars could learn the biblical languages, Latin, Greek and Hebrew. So they needed, well, first, books in Latin, Greek and Hebrew, and they needed a reference library. It's still there and it had a purpose. So it stayed in place. The library in Leiden is founded in 1575. So we could say that's a new one compared to the other ones, but same idea. This library had a purpose. So humanists wanted to have reference books and reference collections, and they started with that. So we still have that where it was put. I could give many other examples. I'll jump to Macpherson. So it's certainly not what was there here before 1963 that we have as the core of these collections. And so the special collections are not the ones that were here before the library was open to public. So these are grafts, as I call them. And so they come from private or public collections. And I'll show you some, for instance, some books coming from the Provincial Museum for Natural History. So we do have books on birds, books on plants that come from this museum that became the Royal Museum of BC and so got divested of many books. So why would you make a collection and give it to a library? Well, first, librarians can have an idea in mind, like teaching with these books, for instance, and we'll see that in Macpherson, the first librarians here gathered books that allow us now to teach history of the book, history of humanism, and history of ideas. So these books are here and they have a purpose with teaching. It can also be a passion. So obviously we do have book collectors who came in Victoria with their collections and gave them as a legacy and memory to this library. And we'll see two of them. One is the Gibson collection, mini collection of books of history of medicine. So that's special, meaning specific collection. Also, what we see is that in a library like Macpherson, private collections become public. So that's also something we see in older libraries. These collections that were associated with one individual or one group become accessible to a larger audience. And sometimes the link, so the communication that would allow this access to be large and fruitful is not made because the collection is not known. I'm going to give you three brief examples before I jump to our special collections and try and see what they are. The first one is called The Hell of the National Library in France. So that's a very special collection. It's in the basement, so, well, it used to be in the basement. And so we could, you could think that that's why it was called the hell, but it's where the books that are forbidden of circulations are kept. Because the National Library in France, since Charles V, is keeping a copy of every book published, in theory. So books that are forbidden still must be kept somewhere, but we don't want to have readers. So pornography, attacks on the government and so on are put in this place called the hell of the library. And now, of course, we do have extensive catalogues of this hell, and this is one of the favorite collections of researchers. The second one is a cupboard, the cupboard of the books given by Joseph Just Scaliger to the Library of Leiden. It was an amazing collection of Oriental and scholarly manuscripts. And I'll show you the cupboard with the next slide. Last thing is restricted access, books that we don't want people to know about. But still, we don't want to get rid of them. So they are there. It's sealed. The librarians know what they are, and no readers. So what we've seen there is that special can be mean beloved, of course, but it means also specific, coming from another source. It means also this recent status between private collections and public readings. And what we have here in this new library with new collections is a series of graphs that actually draw the portrait of the community in Victoria and in Jøvik in the last 50 years. So that's what I'll try to address. So first, I'll bring you to Leiden in this desecrated church, which has been the library of this Calvinist university during the 17th century. And with the laser, I show you here a little cupboard. And people want to have access to what is in this cupboard. That's the special books, special manuscripts. Okay, another way of having a special collection, it's still in Leiden, it's here. It's called the Tiziana Library. It's the library built on specially to host the collection of books of Tisius. And it's still there. So you can the books are kept here at the second floor, so they are not flooded, and it's nice and quiet. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life, because the building was conceived just to keep these books, and they are still together as they were on the bookshelves. This is my favorite library in the world. This is the library Mazarin, la Bibliothèque Mazarin in Paris. What you see here looks like reference books, but actually that's a secret door leading to the offices of the librarians. And so it's amazing. This library has not been done in 1 year, but that's the private collection of the Cardinal Mazarin. And it's a very interesting one, because he was a man, maybe one of the most hated men in the history of France. So he started to collect flyers and pamphlets against him. So, and we even have a literary genre in France, which is called le Mazarinade, which is a piece of satire against Mazarin. Okay, so that was clever to collect them. But then, so this special collection became the core of a much bigger library with books that were very often dedicated to politics, scientific topics, and so on. And you can see on the bookshelves that old books and new books are mixed. So that's the growth like the trunk of a tree, you know. Start with a core and keep growing. Okay, so what we have in our special collections, and I'm very, very grateful to Daniel, who gave me the files for the catalogue so that I can see, okay, everything that we have in 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, and so on, is a collection of mini collections, plus the Segers books that are. So first, we do have a library which is conceived as a university library. And that has several consequences. First, there is a deep link between humanism in Renaissance and book collecting. Because humanists are the ones who say that a good library is the beginning for a good head. So you start with a reference library. And also they instill the love for books and for collections of books. Also, they are the first printers. So everything happens at the same time. So we do have a very interesting humanist collection that was acquired by the librarians in the 60s and 70s, when the university was obviously dotted with illimited means. We do have also a library which attracted the generosity of generous donors and book collectors. I'll speak very briefly of three of these collections. The first one is the collection by Bruce and Dorothy Brown. They do have in the back of the reading room here a window devoted to the best pieces of this collection. It comprises manuscripts and books, and it's absolutely amazing. So the second one is Dr. Gibson, and I'll show you pictures of naked men. The third one, which is not catalogued yet, is the Jackson collection. So that's how it looks when it's not catalogued. It has these little slips there. It's a collection of prayer books, and it's absolutely beautiful. So I think there are 40 books, if I'm right, from the 17th to the 19th century. But what I wanted to show you is, in this special collection, special readers. So readers who left their imprint in our books. So first, readers who not only defaced, but annotated books, added their names or the way they feel, or they colored pictures. Sometimes you'll see they use the books as rough paper just to play. They do that especially on Bibles. So I'll show you some of these. But also, with Bibles, we do have another type of inscriptions. That's collective memory of families. So we do have, and I'll show you the real thing, these two Luther Bibles here that keep generation after generation, the mention of all the people born and dead in one family, and the book is passed to the next generation. We do have two English Bibles as well that are here with the same kind of inscriptions. Also, readers that came to Victoria and longed for London, for the flowers of London, the birds of London, the cottages of Sussex, and also who were quite interested in the literature of exploration and journeys. So, for instance, they collected books on India and British Empire in Himalaya, things like that. And we do have that here. I'll finish, if I have time, with four special readers. First, a worshipper of Virgil, who went on the tomb of Virgil and so on, so I'll show you that. Second, a young man who is called Edgar and doesn't want to be called James. third, but you'll have it already, a young man who must have been shut up in a room with the Bible to meditate on it and wrote in the margins, "I'm crying alone, nobody loves me," and so on. And then a priest, that's in the Segers collection, annotating a dictionary of cases of conscience, which is quite interesting, actually. So, first, humanist collection of humanist books. This is my area of expertise, and I had my cup of tea, and even my piece of cake, looking at the books that we have here. I think that the idea first when the special collections were opened were that we would teach a history of book printing and history of ideas with this collection. And I think it's going to happen, really. So first, it's a tradition. New libraries, when they open, they want to have this kind of books that are icons. So they are symbols for trusting the book to keep forever the best text that we should teach and never forget. And these books are beautifully done by several dynasties of printers. I say dynasties because that's the beginning of printed books. And once you have done the investment of the material, the workshop, and to learn the tricks and the craft, well, you don't want that to be lost at each generation. And actually, they get better and better as time goes by. So the first one I'm going to talk about is Aldus in Venice. And he is the inventor of paperback editions, but also of the italic character and of a certain idea of scientific quality of the editions. The second one will be about Stephanus, and I'll show you some classics published in the 16th century as well. So, first one is in this collection of Aldus. Am I right there? Yeah, okay, sorry. And this is a book by Statius, 1502, and you see at the end the device of the printer. So that's an anchor here with a dolphin around. And I couldn't resist. So, and it was owned by someone who tried to copy very nicely the characters and also copied a piece which is from a lexicon, I think, Latin and Greek. So a would-be humanist, I would say, in the 16th century. I couldn't resist telling you about this device. So I'm sorry for the ones who already know it. This device was a symbol for all printers, so they would sign their books with something that represent themselves. And it's very often enigmatic. In this case, it's an imitation of a piece, a coin, a Roman coin by Emperor Vespasianus in Rome. And it's supposed to puzzle you. So what does it mean? Why do we have this dolphin around this anchor? We are very lucky because we do have a thorough explanation of this. And I'll put that on the web, so you don't need to read all the thing, but I wanted that it's somewhere. So we are very lucky because Aldus called on the best editor of the whole 16th century, Desiderius Erasmus, to come and help him editing Greek and Latin texts. And Erasmus and Aldus became friends during these years in Venice, and Erasmus dedicated to Aldus the second book of his collection of adagia, which means mottos, proverbs, witty sayings. And the first adagium of the second book is Festina lenti, make haste slowly. And he says this is the device, the motto that goes with the printer's device of Aldus. So why? Because we do have here, okay, first a circle that says forever. So if we have a circle, that means that this is always valid. Then second, we do have the fastest animal in the world, the dolphin, going around the anchor, which represents the absence of movement. So what does it mean? Make haste slowly. Well, he keeps telling about that. He says, well, this means that when you want to do something really well, as Aldus is doing, it takes time before you can do it very quickly. And this is how he's doing his adagia as well. And so he says, also, this is a very good symbol because everyone who loves literature knows that this is how literature is written and printed. And this is what Aldus is doing. So he's making it more famous than any Roman emperor would have done. and he is talking about the miracles of printing. So we do have 9 little volumes by Aldus. This is one, for instance, and you can see that it's very, very elegant. We do have mainly classical authors, and always with the device. I'll show you all of them because this is beautiful. We have an interesting one, which is by the grandson of the first Aldus. And you see that the paper here doesn't look as nice as the first ones. Well, it's cheaper and it's made for students. Because these small books, you can put them in your pocket. It's quickly printed and it's cheap. So you can buy it even when you don't have a fellowship. So you can't now. You see that also because here we have what is called the guideline letter. So it was supposed to be filled with a woodcut, with a beautiful initial letter. But this would have meant a second row at the printing press. They can't do that. This is the cheap edition. We also have an interesting book, which could be the emblem of humanism at the time of Aldus. That's a collection of orations by Muret, who is a French humanist, and he had to leave France because he was a little too friendly with the Protestants. But you see him here, he's nice. But what is interesting is that to make the binding here of the book, they decided that it would be nice to have something with parchment. And they happened to have a religious manuscript by color. So they took it. So it's not very nice, but I didn't want to open it when I took the photographs. They took it and just made the binding with a medieval manuscript. Yeah, well, you're a printer, you're a humanist. You think that, well, if the text is printed, you don't need to keep all these manuscripts. And anyway, they are full of mistakes. So let's go to the second great collection of humanist prints, the Stéphaniana, meaning from the family of the Etienne. They are all called, at all generations, either Robert or Henri or Charles or Paul. So we can give them numbers. Henri I starts at the end of the 15th century, and he marries the widow of a German printer. So you know that printing started in Germany. German printers went all over Europe, in Subiaco, for instance, in Italy, but also in Paris, called by the Sorbonne. And so Henri I married the widow of one of these printers and so inherited the workshop and the material and the craft too. When he died, his widow married Simon de Colline, I'll show you one of his books, who was at this time the next best printer in Paris. So far, so good. His son, Robert I, is fascinated by the Bible. When he gets married, he asks his mother to give him the Alcala Bible, which is polyglottis, with the Hebrew and the Greek text, around, in the middle, the Latin Vulgate text. And it wasn't the first Bible of tolerance and open-mindedness. The Cardinal Jiménez, who edited this Bible, said, when you look at the Latin text and on two sides, the Hebrew and the Greek text, it's as if you were looking at the hill of the Golgotha with our Savior and the two thieves on his sides. So it's not tolerance yet, but he had that and he wanted to edit the Greek and the Latin Bible with a satisfactory text. So Erasmian too. And he was very good. He started in 1526 to work at that. And he did that for all his life. except that when he wasn't protected by the king anymore, because the king had died, he had to leave Paris. And he went to Geneva, converted to Calvinism, kept publishing Bibles, and told his son, Henry II, that he would give him the printing shop and the motto and the device and everything if he stayed in Geneva. So Henry said yes, of course, and then tried for all his life to go back to Paris, but couldn't. Nevertheless, he was the best scholar for Greek, and he wrote the first Greek dictionary ever. That's the Thesaurus Linguae Graecae, and he worked in Geneva. So this is the family device, and we do have here in this library 6 of these editions. So that's really a treasure. We do have one of the last editions done by Robert when he was in Paris. That's the one of Valerius Maximus. But we do also have the editions of Greek tragedies by Henri II. There is also Robert II, but I won't mix you up. And we also have a good collection of editions of the classics done in Paris in the 16th century, like Plinius, done by Gilles de Gourmont, you see here, and he was one of the first printers in Paris. I didn't take pictures because it looked dilapidated on my photographs. But we also have a Simon de Colline, so that's Virgil. And you see these beautiful initial letters he was famous for. So he's the father-in-law, no, he's the stepfather of Robert I. And you see this very trendy thing in the 1540s, they like to have dispositions of letters that made sense. So you can imagine what they do when they want to talk about wine and drinking. But this is much more serious. This is a double page from this collection. And you see also what it was done for. So here you have the Latin text, and here you have the commentary. And people who came at the last lecture, it should remind you of the Bible, with the verse of the Bible, big character, and the commentary in small characters. So this is the new status for classics for these humanists. So they're going to do Bible and biblical and classical studies in the same way. This is in Basel, and this is one of these exceptions of the Segos books. I think that Bishop Orth was much more interested in classics and book collecting than in assembling a very orthodox collection. And so we do have some classical humanist books in the Segos collections. And I showed you last time, you know, when the name was erased, because that was Hugo Wolf, Petrus Wolf, and they didn't want to know about him. Same thing, we do have iconic books of humanism, very well-known books. First, we do have, and I won't show them to you because they don't look so nice, but this is Petrarch, and you can recognize the laurel of the Laureatus Poeta. We do have 4 16th century editions of Petrarch's poems, and they are commented like a classic. We do have other rare and obscure poets of the Roman Empire, like Claudianus. But we do have here a very important edition if you're studying French language. This is the translation, this is only the first volume, there are 4 of them, of the Lives of Illustrious Men by Plutarch. And Francis I, who could never learn Greek, still wanted to know about these lives. So the idea of Plutarch is that he takes an illustrious Greek man and an illustrious Roman man. And he's going to give two biographies and compare the two fates and the two destinies. So Francis I hired someone, Jacques Amyot, first to read to him the Greek versions, and second, to write this translation. Well, Francis I was dead when it came out, but still this is a monument of the French language. Same thing with the Diodorus of Sicily that we do have printed. I think I show you that. No, I don't show that. So it's printed in Basel, and it's a monument of erudition. So we do have books that we could lecture for days on, just on one copy, because they are important books for the history of ideas. We also have books that relate to religion and that are not in the Seger's books. So we do have a collection of works by Calvin, and you see that here. I ask you to appreciate that the printer made this little touch of sophistication of putting Jo Calv, which is Jean Calvin, so that's the beginning, in the decorations, the typographical decorations of the whole book. And we do have a collection of Bibles, so that's where I'm coming. So you see here the bad photograph of this one, printed in 1584 in Wittenberg. And you recognize, of course, here, that this is Martin Luther. So this is the German translation of the Bible. And this book has been used to keep memory of the family. So because we are not so many of us, you can see it here. Jean, you know it. Mm-hmm. Same kind, a Luther Bible, published by Hans Luft, and still in Wittenberg. I don't know how it came to Sydney, BC, but this is where the last owner was. So here you see a choir that was added when it was bound, which is that. And this is the whole history of the family who owned this Bible. So, and it will finish on the other side. It looks a little silly when we have the last owner. So that's the Ex Libris of Rose Brink. So don't do that in books. I mean, because forever after that, you're stuck with the... Okay, this Luft Bible has been illustrated by Cranach, so it's very well known. And all the illustrations have been colored by hand. Mm-hmm. And you can think also of the work of piety that it is to color all the ornated letters and all the illustrations of the volume. So that's a way of praying. So I'm going to close your eyes. I'll go very quickly through the Bibles because you saw the real thing. Ah, yes. No, that's too quick. We also have books of religious piety, like The Commonplaces of Theology by Philip Melanchthon. And you see here that it belonged to a man who gave it to a second man in 17-something. What is very interesting in this book is that we do have an extant commentary of all the commonplaces of theology. And the reader took the pain of checking the references and adding more references to all the ones that were there. So we do actually have a book and the notes taken on the book and made after the book. Melanchthon was a disciple and friend of Martin Luther. Sorry, I should have said that. And this is really a 16th century writing, very interesting sample. We have a book which is iconic for French culture. You remember the Bibliothèque Mazarine? The first librarian was a strange and interesting man called Gabriel Naudet. Here. He was a medical doctor, he was also a lawyer, but he decided he preferred to be a librarian. And he wrote a book on how to classify and how to arrange books in a library. So that's the first book that we have about that. He also wrote a beautiful book about people who have been accused of being magicians and have died at stake for that and were just smart. So this is what we have. And he chooses here a quotation of Seneca saying, we would pardon many people if we stopped being angry before we judged them. So, nice motto, isn't it? We have that here, and it's commented on the book with in many blank pages by someone, I would say, in the 19th century, saying, this book is very well known, or this man was the librarian in Paris, and so on. So that's quite interesting. We also have a collection of books telling us the history of medicine in 16th, 17th century. So they were all given by the same doctor, Dr. Gibson, who wrote a little piece in the Canadian Journal for Medicine, so which was not about history of medicine and not about books, on this collection and the fact that he gave it to the University of Victoria. So what did he give us? First, the best book ever written on anatomy, Vesalius' book printed in Basel. I'll show you that. And this is this one here that has been burnt a little. So you can imagine whatever you want. I don't think it was taken out from the stake, but we never know. And it's beautifully bound, and it was restored before it was given to the library. We also have books on how to make remedies, how to make balms, unguents, pills. We have a very strange English small book on everything you can need at some point and which is easy to do. So I think it was a book for barbers. So first, wounds in the head, but then if you have a hernia, let's do it. If you have hemorrhoids, let's do it too. There were two pages left blank, so he put the oath of Hippocrates. But then there was still half a page and he put a recipe against a headache. Here you have a book by Fernel, which is beautiful, and I'll show you that. It's in Latin and Greek and beautifully written, and it's a sum on non-chemical medicine. And then we do have the anatomical exercises of Dr. Harvey, who demonstrates in 1623 that the blood is pumped by the heart and circulates through the arteries and comes back through the veins. So no more animal spirits pushing, aspiring, and pulling the liquids. So first, some of the Vesalius. Vesalius is well known to have published in 1543, the very same year as Copernicus published his book on celestial revolutions, and in the same city, Basel. So two eminent books, really, at this time. He published, so in 1543, a book where he claimed to be the first one to look at the body as it is and not as Galen says it should be. So, for instance, he's going to see, and you see him here performing a dissection in front of a huge crowd of ancient physicians, but also students. Here you have a monkey. Here there is a goat and a dog. Here there is a man trying to see. Up there you have little pretties who are very much interested in what's happening. And he's going to say that first, men do have an equal number of ribs on the left and right side. So, because for a long time, because of a mistake in reading the Bible, people thought that Eve had been made out of a rib of Adam. She was made in the back of Adam in Hebrew. But if you don't understand what in the back means, you say, well, out of a rib. So medical doctors would open corpses and say, that's a male. He's missing a rib on the left side. Well, he also established that both kidneys are at the same height, which is contrary to what Galen was saying and so on. But, and more importantly for us, he was an artist and he asked artists to depict the body. So for us, it's not realistic. But for the time, it was supposed to be a substitution to going, actually, to the dissection. This is for Catherine, who is there. That's the lesson of anatomy of Dr. Tulip. And you see that he's dissecting here exactly the same muscles as Vesal is doing here. Okay, so these are some plates of this amazing book. And it's maybe the most well-known book in history of medicine. So we could do a whole workshop just with that. These are the ornated letters, initial letters, all very interesting. This is the book by Harvey. And I'm sorry for the quality of the pictures, but I didn't want to break them open. So, and this is the book by Fernel. And you see, it's full of poems in Latin and Greek, showing that when you have, at this time, 17th century, a medical training, you're supposed to be a humanist first. So, this is my favorite little book on everything. And you'll see what I haven't told you, which is the second piece, a complaint on the abuse of the noble art of chirurgery. And I don't think it's ever been published. Books bearing testimony of their readers, and I'll go very quickly now. So many ways of inscribing your use of books. This is in the Seger's collection, and many of them have that. First, the Bibles. So I want to show you two English Bibles called the British Bibles, because the translation of this originally Genevan Bible was that Adam and Eve were in breeches when God saw them. So, first, this one, published in 1599, and you will see two kinds of annotators. This one is telling the life of all the people who owned it after 1740. So, telling the names, where people were married, who were their children. So, keeps going. And this is my transcription of that. So you see, basically, names. It's like going to a cemetery and seeing the tombstone. Okay, but then, in the margins, you see something else, and that's before. That's actually in 1713, I think. And you see, okay, so someone who is learning how to write, imitating what is written here. Okay, and then you see here, still learning how to write. And then doing something incredible. This. That. That's in the family Bible. Okay, other thing, same kind of thing is in the Seger's. That's the Groves English Dictionary, Greek and English Dictionary. And that's my transcription. That's in the 19th century. Edgar, not Jack, as a certain young man calls me. So, another Bible with no unruled scribbler, where you have here again all the names of the family, and then you have two things that are quite interesting. Oh, I didn't show that. First, in the same year, he lost his wife and his sister, and that's the year he decides to write everything there. Second, he copies a poem by Keats, saying that he finds consolation only in the Bible and poetry. So that's very moving, well, to me, I think. This one is the smallest Bible I could find, and it's very convenient. It's published in 1774 in London, and that's an abbreviation of the Bible. It has illustrations in case you would be bored, because that's too long. And it was a part of the Brown collection, these book collectors who loved marvels. This one you've seen, that's the Luther Bible with the inscriptions. I'm going faster and faster because I see that time is not nice. That's the Luther Bible of 1560 with this family register and the silly Ex Libris and this beautiful coloring. And this is a very small letter, so Apocalypse is of course where all the colors are the most vivid. And now we do have three book worshippers I would like to introduce you to. This is a London edition of Virgil in 1763 or 73, I can't remember, 63. And it's ornated with beautiful engravings, but what I found most touching was the fact that we have here some thyme cut, so picked up on the tomb of Virgil, which had been conveniently exhumed in the 19th century when Virgil was the king of poets and people were going in Italy, especially from the British islands, to find and to recite poems by Virgil in front of bays and volcanoes. So here you have the two lines by Virgil, and here picked up on the tomb of Virgil in April 1890. The book itself is absolutely beautiful, and it was a college prize for Claude Ardoin. And that's very interesting because this Claude Ardoin is very well known as a lawyer and a historian in France at the end of the 18th century. So we do have two worshippers here. And he was the first one, yes, he was the first one in writing here, in writing Latin verse, which is not so easy because you have the scansion and the meters and so on. So in these books, you have for each piece of Virgil a full page engraving. I took the 10th eglogue, and still, you know, I didn't want to break it open. You see here that it's about bees. And in the margins and the decorations, you have the bees attacking the putties. And everything is perfect in this book. It's one of the, you see here, the beehives. So that's on the left page. And on the right page, the bees attacking the little angels. We do have a Virgil reconstructed on a very old manuscript, 1741, owned by someone who is signing with Greek mottos. And that's very interesting because I think that these two someones were two men, and writing in Greek was also an allusion to Greek love. Still, they annotated it profusely. Last thing is this collection of cases of conscience. It's in the Segers collection. I show you that not for the state, because I would like you to feel sorry and donate something, but because it shows us that these books were used and read. And what is this dictionary? It's a way of answering questions. If you don't know, for instance, and you're a priest, that's a problem, should you drink from the chalice when you're standing in front of the altar or kneeling in front of the altar? So that's a big question, and it's commented here and here and here. So conclusion by our beloved Segers is that you should be standing when you drink. That's the conclusion of that. There is another annotation. Is that worst? If someone comes in confession and says, Father, I masturbated, or Father, I fornicated with the wife of someone else. So big, big question, because obviously the natives had this question a lot of times. And so you must tell them, and that's in the margins, that none is worse because the two of them are just awful. Never. And you should not say one is less important than the other one, because otherwise you're going to push everyone to this sin. My last book, I'll show it to you right now. Yeah, okay. Is this one. It's the Plants of London, end of 18th century. And it's also nostalgia for London and its surroundings. It's painted by hand, every second page. And I invite you to see the subtlety of the colors. And it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. Okay, finish by books that talk together. We do have in this library the first book published on the... Where is my thing? Okay, so that I won't show you. Okay, this one. The first book published on the Native Americans of Canada, which doesn't tell about their superstitions, but is describing their religion with respect. 1724, it's in French, by a Jesuit father, the father Lafitteau, who published that with the permission of his superiors. But then the next year, the superiors regretted a lot. So he showed with pictures how all the ceremonies were performed. But then it was easy, and that's what is called in a book published last year, the book that changed Europe. It was easy to describe exactly on the same outline, with the same kind of engravings, the rites and ceremonies of the Catholic religion, which is what a Protestant did. He was called Picard, and he was working with Jean-Frédéric Bernard, and he wrote the ceremonies and customs of the religions in the world, taking his outline from this French book that we have. We do not have this book, but we do have, by the same author, the English translation of The Praise of Hell, or A Discovery of the Infernal World, describing the advantages of that place with regard to its situation, antiquity, and duration. And it's one of the best books I've read recently. I was amazed by that. Hell is a place where, obviously, everyone wants to go, and they want to run there. So look around you, and people just can't wait to get there. So that's very funny, and I invite you to have a look at it after that. This is the inspiration of Jean-Frédéric Bernard, who is writing that, and you see all the people who know hell coming and telling him how it is and how to write, the tourist guide to hell. So according to where you want to go.